Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. It's a story of glamour and scandal and political intrigue and a battle for the soul of a nation. Hollywood Exiles from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
In terms of the actual journey that you guys went through, like the whole journey, and maybe this is too much of a loaded question, but like, what kind of impacts did this entire fucked up, like wild experience that not many, like, you know, really not a lot of people have gone through? Like, what kind of impacts did this have on your general mental health?
Well, just to give you like timeline perspective, I joined when I was 26, was just turning 27. I was there for my whole 30s and I left just before my 40th birthday. Wow. So I had my, you know, all my 30s there. And that's a real, there's a big pivotal life changes and shifts that happen in those times, obviously. So, you know, Nippy and I talk about this a fair bit, like in, when we're reflecting in many ways, and I think this is healthy, although slippery slope, we have to say, you know, I wouldn't change a thing because here we are. We have these two beautiful boys. I never would have met Nippy had I not met Mark and joined Nexium with this, you know, Southern boy living in New York. Like, how could that have happened? So I love my life. I love who we are. I love what we're building. So I have to like look at that whole journey as just part of my, whether you want from a spiritual perspective, the life's purpose. Was I brought in so that I could be the bright light to get up to the highest level possible and then, you know, be a part of the exposure to expose this guy? Like, I wanted, before I joined Nexium, to have a meaningful and purposeful life.
Yeah.
Right. And I thought that Nexium was that thing. Obviously, we bet on the wrong horse, but now we're out of it, having way more impact in terms of purpose or meaning than we ever could have had in, you know, the 17,000 people went through Nexium. 2 million people have listened to our podcast. Like, to me, it was that meant to happen so we could do this? I don't fucking know. Mm-hmm. All I know is that it was really wonderful when I was in it for a time being. It was a very beautiful place with some weird things that I couldn't wrap my head around, but was always trumped by like, but the good of it. Mm. All those good things you mentioned, the connection, the helping people, the personal awareness, the self-evolution, all those good things. Then to answer your question about the mental health, dig into that for a second. Getting out, I almost like can't put myself back there because it was such a massive betrayal. And there was so much for me personally, PTSD around like just what I had to do to understand that I was out there pitching and vouching for this guy who not only turned out to be the opposite of what he said, but so dark and so evil, and that I was a part of that. Like, that was a huge, awful reconciliation. And to understand like all the impact of all the people that I brought in, and then they, you know, in the pyramid of the MLM pyramid scheme, is that there, you bring people in and they bring people in. So the effects of that. And also like with the Nexium teaching is that like, you have to take responsibility for your mistakes. So here I am going like, I'm responsible for all these people. That was part of the reason why we blew the whistle. Is like, I was so loud about how great it was. I had to be equally as loud about how bad it was.
Right.
And to put myself out there in that way, like, yeah, or louder, to put myself out there to be like the spokesperson for that was terrifying. It was terrifying, you know, and it was like, you know, it was the right thing to do. I felt I needed to do it, but I didn't think about like how that was going to impact my kids, you know, or how that would impact, you know, how the neighbor sees me, the neighbor who's never watched The Vow, but sees the headline saying like sex cult recruiter tells all. I'm like, you know, there's more to that story. But if you don't know the whole story, that's how you see me. Like, you don't, I wasn't really thinking about those effects. And that does take a mental toll to deal with, like, you know, how people see you. And ironically, that was one of the things I was always working on in NXIVM, is caring less about what people thought of me. Right. They called it like me disease. And I've really had to challenge that to do this. So in many ways I've had that growth.
You are, you know, you and Nippy and Mark and his, and I'm blanking
Bonnie.
On his Bonnie. Yeah. I mean, you know, you guys are the architects of a man who very much deserves to be in jail, being in jail, not doing this to anybody else.
I appreciate that.
And I would put that into certain context for you. I always have a little, I wouldn't say balk, but a little bit of like, I want to add a caveat when I hear the term whistleblower, for this reason and this reason alone. After Sarah got branded, we went on our like 3-week campaign of telling everyone what happened. And, you know, I wrote a letter to the president of the company saying WTF, basically, and no phone calls from the leadership, nothing. Just Claire Bronfman decides to get on a plane 5 weeks after and go to the Vancouver Police Department to have my wife arrested for mischief, fraud, and theft. And the charges that she had and the evidence she had was a lie, right? Which then put us in a defensive, right, where we were going to have to go through legal woes, which is what they had done. They just buried all their enemies in litigation. So in a lot of ways, yes, we were doing the right thing, but we got dragged into a fight where we
could have handled it very differently.
They could have handled it like, but that's where they had lost touch with reality, because I was betting on a large scale that there would be a public outcry against branding women's privates as a means to teach them personal, professional and development and character and honor. Right. That's what I was like, okay, you guys are on that side. I'm on this side. The optics of this, when we put all our cards on the table, are going to show us is like, we're not in the wrong, but you created the fight even more. So it put us in a position of like, we have to burn our boats. We're all in. Like we got, I mean, if we don't win this, we're fucked. Right. So, and it kind of ties into the earlier part of your question. It's like, we were in a fight. I was in a street fight and
it was a war for at least a year.
And it was like that for a while. And I describe it as being, you know, when you're on a plane, it's a lot of comfort, but when you hit that turbulence, your fight or flight's going off.
Yeah.
Right. And it kind of felt like we were on a 8 to 9 month plane ride where fuck, the turbulence would hit and your fight or flight was going off all the time. And there was shrapnel being thrown into your central nervous system. And it was a lot of that. So there's that element of it. Then there's dealing with how you got conned, the embarrassment of looking stupid, your pride taking a hit on a international scale to a certain extent. And so there was that kind of egg on your face, right? So there was the initial shock trauma of it and kind of like, what do I, you know, where am I in my life? I have a kid. We had no income. So there's just the physical kind of like, and they were intentionally doing it and we knew their playbook. Right. So we kind of knew like, shit, this might not end well for us. And then he got arrested and the New York Times article came out and I felt a relief.
I can imagine that there is during that time and you know, once the branding happened and then once you decided to, you know, take on this fight, I imagine that there's a lot of decisions that you have to make and sort of how to proceed. And there's constantly things that you have to deal with. And I'm curious from your relationship perspective, like how did you like dealing with this incredibly traumatic and challenging situation, but also trying to like align and make decisions together and, you know, deal with the fact that you're like learning that you're in this cult sort of at the same time. Like how did you communicate with one another to sort of like navigate that?
We were on the phone with Mark and Bonnie and a team of people almost every single day. So
it's a war room in our home.
Yeah. We made a lot of really good decisions in a short amount of time and we had a lot of people kind of serendipitously show up.
Even just like the New York Times article, like, and then Moira, who took over started the investigation, Moira Penza, like the people that came in and took it off our hands very quickly was, I mean, I don't know how that happened, but it was, we're very grateful for it. And it couldn't have gone better, you know, 120 yeah. years, right?
Yeah. No, and he got arrested in under a year and convicted in under two.
Yeah, that is so quick. That is
very
quick.
Pretty amazing.
In terms of like the actual recovery afterwards, when all is said and done, I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, but I can't imagine that you're trying to take that on yourself. Did you guys decide to like seek therapy, specifically therapy with like with someone who specializes in deprogramming and you know, cult survivors?
Yep. We spoke to, well, Janja Lalić. This book is like
that the book thing I helped a lot.
Recommend the most.
The book
to
is
people.
Called "Take Back Your Life." Janja Lalić, who was on Sick Boy not long ago, who also wrote "Escaping Utopia." You got in touch with Janja.
We actually did an interview together. I met her on the set of, it was called Cults and Extreme Beliefs. This is before I did The Vow. And the book was recommended to me. Mark, Bonnie had left before us and she like kind of gathered up a bunch of resources. So when we left, somebody, thanks to Bonnie, like all of a sudden we had this list of what to read and what documentaries to watch. And that was a huge part of our deprogramming, was seeing it in other groups where it's so obvious. Like if you watch Going Clear or Holy Hell about Buddha Field, even Wild Wild Country, which I'm not crazy about, but I'll talk about that later. Like you see the patterns, and that helped us. But we spoke to Dan Shaw, who's a specialist in cults and narcissists. He also was part of the yoga community, Siddha Yoga, which is, I think, in upstate New York. And I think actually where Keith studied to learn about how to be a guru and how to be like, you know, a leader of the people. I know.
Gross. What's up with upstate New York? Is it like a hotbed?
It's a hotbed.
Like cult startups?
Yeah. Hotbed. Hot. We have to go there for a wedding in October.
Well,
and I'm like,
there's nothing up there. You been up there?
No,
I have not.
It sucks.
It really sucks. I'm really glad we don't ever have to go there again, except Saratoga. I like Saratoga. But anyway, I was going to say the other thing, like I've taught a big part of our podcast now is a focus on healing. And I really like, we talk to these people who are still in trauma and they're survivors. And I'm like, just trying to give them my healing playbook. And it's, I talk a lot about just the importance of self-education, proper therapy, finding a therapist also that doesn't trigger you. Like a lot of people who are in NXIVM went to therapy, and because NXIVM was a therapy based curriculum, there's questions that are similar to what a normal healthy therapist would ask you. But if you're like getting asked that, or a friend, there's so many just questions in the question set that we would have as coaches. So then they'll go to a therapy session and be like, I can't do this because it reminds me too much of NXIVM. So you have to like find someone that works for you, that's trauma informed, coercive control informed in our case. And that's a big part of what drives us now is telling these stories so people have access to these types of therapists and these types of conversations, which weren't even around much when we were coming out. So in many ways, we're like providing a free, not therapy, but like a good supplement to therapy.
Yeah.
And The Vow did a good job of setting it up, because I think The Vow did a good job of extending the subjects a certain level of credibility and respect, as opposed to just going in and doing the obvious documentary.
Which
allowed us to segue nicely into this, because I think, you know, instead of being the dumb people who fell for a cult, we were the people that looked like shit. How did those people fall for it?
Absolutely.
That was a clip from the Sick Boy podcast. You can listen to the full interview with Sarah Edmondson and Anthony Nippy Ames and other episodes right now by searching for Sick Boy on the CBC Listen app and everywhere you get your podcasts.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.